Welcome to the Living Out Podcast, helping people, churches, and society talk about faith and sexuality.
Hello, and welcome to the Living Out Podcast. My name is Andy Robinson, and you've joined us for episode 3 of our series aimed at church leaders. Now, we're talking about church leaders in a very broad context, so you might be a paid church leader, you might be an elder, a PCC member, a small group leader, or perhaps a mature church member hoping to influence others. At whatever context you're in, we hope this will be useful. And I'm joined by two of my Living Out colleagues who also have experience in church leadership. So hello, Ed. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Hello.
Adam was far more enthusiastic with the hello there,
I am in a freezing church hall. I'm showing what church leadership is all about by sitting in the corner of a freezing church hall on a Monday morning. But, you know, that's asking for a bit of sympathy for my unenthusiastic hello.
Excellent. This is going to be fun, isn't it? So let me start by, we've all been church leaders at various points. So we're going to look in this episode at the theme of pastoral care, how we care for people and families in the area of same-sex attraction. So before we get into that, Ed and Adam, any amusing incidents from your history of helping people and trying to care for them? Go on, Ed.
How long have you got? I mean,
yeah, I know.
I mean, the worst one is when I fell asleep during a pastoral sort of conversation with somebody. They were telling me all about their love life, and it was good. I just fell asleep, and then you wake up, you come to, and you say anything. I had to pretend I was praying. I just thought the damage I was going to do by telling this person that their love life was so boring that I fell asleep during it. So I don't know whether there's probably some interesting ethics to discuss there as whether I did the right thing, but I fell asleep during a pastoral conversation. That is just one of many ways in which I have got pastoral care badly wrong. And if anybody's listening, including the person whose love life I fell asleep during, my apologies.
Okay, I will look out for you seeming to pray during future conversations. Thanks, Ed. Adam, any stories from your end?
Well, sadly, this is a story which I seem to keep on having to relive. And this is where you're in the midst of a deep conversation with someone, and then you suddenly realize that you can't remember their name. and sometimes it's because I just don't know them very well, but we're having this really good conversation in this moment. And sometimes it's simply just my own stupidity, and I do know their name, but it's just dropped out of my head in this moment. And then you get to the stage where you're like, prayer is the most appropriate thing to do right now.
Yes.
And then in my head, I'm like, do I now pray for them in such a way where I don't have to name them? Or do I just have to admit it that I'm really sorry, could you remind me of their name? And in this act of having to ask them that question, undermine them completely.
Yeah. So you end up praying for my brother here or my friend here. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Adrian. Sorry. Easy joke. Funnily enough, mine is the reverse of Ed's. So my experiences of people falling asleep when I'm visiting them, particularly, to be fair, maybe a bit older, maybe I'm visiting them in a nursing home, which always means it's baking hot. And I've had several pastoral meetings where the person I've been speaking to has fallen asleep. And then you're just in the dilemma, do you just sit there? Do you wake them up? Do you leave? So if anybody's got any answers to what you do if you're in a pastoral meeting and the person you're talking to falls asleep, do let us know. But hopefully in the podcast we'll keep you awake with our lively conversation. We're going to think about pastoral care in this episode, and we're dividing it up into two areas. So firstly, we'll talk about how to care for those who are gay, same-sex attracted themselves. And in the second half, we'll think about caring for family members where that's the case. So what we're going to assume in this section is we've got somebody in our church, in our congregation, same-sex attracted is talking to us about that. For this purpose, we're going to assume that they're wanting to live in line with Jesus teaching that marriage is for a man and a woman. Later in the series, we'll talk about instances where that's not the case. Ed and Adam, what's wise practice? What are the things we want to have in mind as we think about caring for somebody, maybe, let's say, I don't know, mid-20s, wanting to live for Jesus, facing some of the pain of not having a relationship, or maybe somebody a bit older? What's helped us? How can we help others? Ed, do you want to start?
Well, I think perhaps the first thing to say is not to panic, because I think people sometimes do panic when it comes to experiences around sexuality, questions around sexuality, somebody say that they're gay, same-sex attracted. And Sean Doherty, one of our founders, does the, well, I don't know whether it's hilarious or totally depressing story of a friend of his basically ringing him up saying, I've got one of you in my study. They've just, I don't know what to do. And Sean was having to say, have you made them a cup of tea? Oh, that's a good idea. Just I think there is a danger of people panicking when it comes to interacting with people like us. And Sean tells that story. And I think it's just worth acknowledging that some people do panic and just need to be reminded to do all the normal things, make them a cup of tea, listen well, ask good questions, don't go into intrusive questions, ask them permission to ask them some questions. Just do the normal thing you do if you were trying to care for somebody. And don't panic would be the first piece of advice.
Good advice.
Yeah, and on that, and that desire not to panic, like how you as a pastor respond to someone when they're open about their sexualities or their struggles with sexuality is going to speak volumes, and like really learning how to do non-judgmental listening. Because I think if a pastor responds with any sort of like unease in their face, in their expressions, in their words, if they seem a bit queasy, if they don't really like talking about this, then suddenly that individual is just going to assume that no one in the church is going to want to talk about this. And maybe this isn't actually a church which is going to recognize them or help them or enable them to flourish faithfully for Jesus. So, yeah, I do think there's an important place for non-judgmental listening.
And just saying thank you, particularly if it is, you know, you get a sense this might be the first time they've mentioned this to anybody. You know, thank them so much for sharing it with you. And, you know, go, don't panic and go, cool, you know, would you mind me asking you or, you know, any particular reason why you wanted to share this with me? Just sort of gently asking people, you know, why they're mentioning it to you and how you can best help. And just being thankful and appreciative to them will make a huge amount of difference.
Mm. Yeah, that's so true.
And it is avoiding making assumptions. We've often said, you know, if you meet one gay same-sex attracted person, you've met one gay same-sex attracted person. And funnily enough, I've made mistakes in this area because this was an area, oh, I know this, you know, I know this. And sort of made the assumption that everybody's story would be the same as mine and then discovered that it wasn't. Because there is just a range. So funnily enough, the people I ended up talking to, I think both are now married to women, and actually in their case, it was possible for them to do that in a way I don't think it ever would have been possible for me. And so you're just asking lots of really open questions, you know, tell me what that's been like for you. Are there times that are particularly hard? Are there any things that you see that are good that have come through this? What are the ways we can help? Again, in a fairly open way, you know, where do you land on this at the moment in terms of, you probably know where we as a church come from. Is that where you're happy to be? Is that hard for you? Just asking loads of open, non-judgmental questions so that if at some point towards the end of the conversation you're going to try and help somebody, you'll be speaking to the reality of their situation rather than a sort of imagined version of it. So lots of just really good open questions and listening alongside, as we said, really thanking them for having shared with us.
That's so true, Andy, about not wanting to go into a conversation with assumptions, because I think I've learned from having lots of conversations now about sexuality that that actually someone's background and their culture is going to determine their experience and their ability to talk about sexuality quite dramatically. If someone comes from a very traditional background and culture, like, there's a good chance I might be the very first person they've ever told, and they might not have the courage to tell someone else again for years. But also they might be so overwhelmed with shame. And actually, that's the thing they really need to talk about, is how our union with Jesus Christ brings us from a place of shame to a place of acceptance. Whereas there might be someone else who comes from a far more affirming sort of culture and background. And they might be saying to my face, oh, I want to live for Jesus. But at the same time, they've already bought into a lot more of the world's sort of assumptions about sexuality, about what it looks like to flourish in life, and about maybe some more liberal sort of perspectives on scripture. And so that person might need a very different sort of conversation. And you're only going to know that if you have asked open-ended questions and actually try and get to know them and their background and how they're viewing their sexuality.
And there may well be a generational difference there. So probably in the assumption they've not really spoken to many people, there's a lot of shame. Probably out of my generation, that would often be the case. I suspect with a younger generation, it will be less the case. Not unknown, but it's less frequent that they won't have spoken to anybody else. Although, Adam, do you want to come back at me on that?
Yeah, I just think I want to add into the conversation that times when I've spoken to young men, and actually they have spoken from places of guilt and shame, and they haven't spoken to many people, I do recognize that they're coming from traditional sort of cultures, and actually they're coming from the Scottish Islands, they're coming from Northern Ireland, they're coming from a black majority church here in London, and actually those cultures which they've grown up in and have shaped them, even though they might appear on the surface that they use TikTok, they wear the trendy clothes, and they should speak like any other 20-year-old, actually their background has shaped them and how they're coming to this issue of sexuality.
That's really helpful. So it's not just a generational question, but a background question as well, which is why don't make assumptions, ask the questions, is really useful. Yeah, thanks, Adam.
And then also don't make, and I think we're hinting at this, but don't make assumptions about the pattern of somebody's same-sex attraction. I think we've probably said on this podcast a few times before is that we all experience same-sex attraction. We all experience sexuality in different ways. And again, the danger of me presuming that somebody else's experience of same-sex attraction is the same as mine, but the danger of you as a pastor listening in thinking, oh, I've dealt with someone like this before. We all know that in every, you know, if we're dealing with somebody who's trying to help somebody who's just lost their husband or wife, it will be very different for different people because of the difference in the relationships, the difference in personality, difference in cultures. And when it comes to somebody who's same-sex attracted, you might have spent years supporting, mentoring someone else who's same-sex attracted, but actually the pattern of their sexual attractions, the shape of their sexuality is completely different to this new person sitting in front of you. But you think, oh, I've done this. And I think we do that as pastors sometimes, that we think, oh, I've got these degree of competencies now because I have helped somebody who's bereaved. I've helped somebody who's same-sex attracted. I've helped somebody with an eating disorder. I've helped somebody with self-harm. I now know how to do this. I've got the certificate. The reality is you've learned some stuff. It will help you. There's some stuff that will transpose across. But actually, it might be that actually what you learned was really helpful to that person who is self-harming is more helpful to transpose across this person with same-sex attraction than what the other person who experienced same-sex attraction went through. Weirdly, you've got to transpose across in different ways and not presume that this person is the same as the other person in this category you once spent time with.
That's helpful. Let's talk a little bit about ongoing support, in as much as we've talked about initial meeting, they've had their cup of tea, they've been listened to, and we've not made assumptions and so on. What might be ways in which we can provide ongoing pastoral care as people experience same-sex attraction?
I think Dee just asked the question, how can we best support you? The answer may be they haven't got a clue. Because, you know, they've just dumped this on you. They're in an emotional state. You're the first person they've ever told. And they don't know. They don't know how you can best support them. I can remember the first few people I told, and they asked me things like, well, how can I best support you? And I hadn't got a clue how to answer that question. And you just might need to say, well, let's meet up again and talk about that and just begin to explore gently what would be best for them. They might, though, have really clear ideas as to how you can best support them. And sometimes those ideas will be really good and helpful. And you can say, yeah, let's just make that happen. I'll meet up with you, you know, every week for the next 6 months or something like that. They might, though, have some completely unrealistic expectations of what might best support, you know, what might, and you might need to then sort of respond differently, but ask them, how do you feel we could best support and help you as a church family member? Because oddly, when that question hasn't been asked, I've certainly told some people, and I've heard of other friends who've been open with somebody in church leadership, and it's never really been mentioned again. And this person has felt quite rejected by the fact that they had this really deep, meaningful conversation, and then it was never, ever mentioned again. And that is not very helpful. And certainly if they do come from a more conservative background and are full of shame, they just think, oh, it almost increases that because they think, well, this clearly wasn't something I should have mentioned. Yeah. I perhaps should put, you know, I should get back in the closet. That's clearly where that person wants me to be because they've never acknowledged we had that big conversation. And so, yeah, making sure there is a conversation around what's happening next, what they need from you as a church family next.
I found sort of three words helpful. Suffering, temptation, blessings. I just have in the back of my mind as I'm talking to people. So where's it hard? You know, if people aren't going to be able to get into a romantic relationship, there will be some of the just the pains of singleness, some of the pains of feeling different. And the people who've helped me most over the years are the ones who've got that. You know, who've got, there are times you'll need to weep with me. And having that in, so it's not just an ethical question, it's also a suffering question. But also temptation, you know, trying to help me to spot where are the ways in which I could be led away from Jesus on this. And of course, once you're into temptation, you're into Jesus being sympathetic, which helps. But also blessings, so trying to avoid somebody just turning in on themselves. If we can get them to a place where they're serving others, then actually they may well find that having gone through or being in the midst of experiences of same-sex attraction just enables them to bless others and serve others and be compassionate towards others. And so if we can avoid people just locking in on themselves and turn them out towards others and actually just finding blessing in that, that's another helpful way of providing support.
And just checking that they're involved in all the ways you would normally want somebody to be involved in church life. Are they part of a small group? Are they serving? Are they regular at church Sunday meetings? You know, would a prayer triplet be a good thing for them? And asking them about their pattern of intimacy with God. Are they enjoying their relationship with God? What do they find hard about reading the Bible? Are they able to talk about their sexuality with God? What Bible passages have they found helpful or might they find helpful? And just exploring some of the basics you'd want to be in place in any Christian's life and make sure that they're in place in this Christian's life.
Part of me wants to say relax as well, you know, smile. There can be a huge amount of intensity about this. Actually, partly just relax will probably help them as well.
I think you need to show people love. If they've been open and honest with you, they might be feeling wounded in that moment, and so you need to help them bind those wounds and show them love and care. I think you need to help draw them into that church family and make them feel like they belong. And for some people, that's going to be just invite them over for dinner with the family or with some other friends once, and that's enough to show them that you care about them. And they might have enough connections around the church that's all they need. But for other people, they're probably going to need a bit more intentional looking after and that sense of that you're really there for them and you really care for them.
I think that's really useful. I know for me, deep friendships have been what have helped me rather than what have hindered me. And sometimes pastoral care that can get very anxious about same-sex friendships can be unhelpful, because friendships will be useful in preventing me from falling into temptation often rather than being a cause of it. And so encouraging friendships like you've just said, Adam, is really useful. There's loads more we could say on this, and there are a whole heap of stuff around the website on this question. But in a minute, we're going to move on to how do we care for families of those who are gay, same-sex attracted.
At the Living Out, a team are coming to Derby in the UK on the 8th of June. And this is your chance, if you live near there or you've got friends near there, to explore the biblical perspective on sexuality, how to engage well with a culture, and what it means to be a biblically inclusive church, as well as ask any questions. You can find out more, you can book a place at livingout.org events.
Well, I don't know about you guys. Certainly my experiences, I've done speaking events for Living Out around the place. I have a handful of conversations with people for whom this is personal. But the conversations I have most often are, hey, my daughter, son is gay, maybe about to get into a same-sex marriage, or my granddaughter, my grandson is. Those are the conversations I have most often. And I suspect churches don't really know, don't think about how we care for people in that position. So, guys, any wisdom on how we care for parents who are struggling to know how to relate to, say, a son or daughter who either is living for Jesus or maybe has just wandered away from the faith and is exploring their sexuality? Any wisdom?
I heard Ed Drew, who works for Faith in Kids, give this advice, and I know that it's warmed the hearts of many a parent, that God chose you to be this child's parent. And God chose you to be this child's grandparents. And they didn't choose anyone else, but they chose you. And that's because you've got what it takes, what is needed to show this child love and to be there for them. And that advice doesn't mean that it's going to be easy or everything's going to go swimmingly and everything's going to go well. But actually, this isn't an accident. Like, maybe your child is same-sex attracted, maybe they're gay, or grandchild, and actually they are at this moment walking away from Jesus Christ and don't want to have anything to do with him. Well, God's chosen you to be that parent in that moment, and he's calling you to like go it for the long haul and go it for the long run. And to keep on being there and to keep on showing the love of Christ to this individual and to keep on speaking about Jesus to them and knowing that actually this is all under his timing and all under his plans and he's not surprised by any of this.
I love that advice. And I also just wonder whether we should be having just general conversations with parents, grandparents about being parents and grandparents to just set the right expectations. Because I think there is a lot of pressure on parents in particular to make their children Christian as if that was within their remit. I mean, obviously, there's a lot that parents could do to bring up kids and to create an environment of grace and truth, to speak the truth and love to them in a way that helps them get to know Jesus, to be like Jesus, to speak. There's loads that parents could do, but at no point in the Bible does it say you know, a parent makes their child Christian or gives the responsibility to parents of making their children Christian. But that's sometimes the expectation that people pick up and that people have in churches, and people can be crushed by that. And when that isn't happening, people can feel, oh, you can't tell the truth. You can't tell your small group that your child and you have a shouting match every Sunday about going to church. You can't tell your small group or ask your small group to pray about the fact that you have just discovered your child in bed with somebody of the same or opposite sex. Or you can't say that actually, when somebody else is saying that their child's really got involved in the CU university, that your child has clearly not got involved in anything Christian at university. And it's an expectation thing and it's an honesty thing, isn't it? That we create this expectation that parents can and should make their children Christian, and that all our children in our churches will somehow turn out Christian if only we've got things right. That's not the case. It puts far too much pressure on parents and on children often. And we just need to recognize that we can do what we can do, you know, with that sort of attitude that Adam was sharing. But actually, our children's eternal destiny is something that we can entrust to God, and that they have a degree of autonomy about themselves. Hmm. Part of having kids is allowing your children to grow up and make their own decisions. And sometimes we don't like the decisions they're made, but you sort of done your job when they actually are making decisions and they've grown up and made decisions, even if you don't like the decisions they're making.
And thinking of church leaders, trying to acknowledge that probably from the front is really helpful. So I don't know about you, often if I was, say, talking about suffering, I would end up with a sort of default, I don't know, maybe you're struggling with ill health or bereavement or redundancy. Whereas often actually the things causing people most pain were often family stuff. And, you know, just as over the years I trained myself to just drop same-sex attraction into lists like, you know, maybe you're struggling with stuff like a sexuality you didn't choose. What I didn't do as well as I should have done, and now I'm trying to repent of, is just stop dropping into the list. I don't know, maybe for you the suffering is you're a parent watching teenage or adult children making decisions you wouldn't want them to make, and that's agony for you. Just dropping that in from the front so that people realize they're understood and they're cared for. We probably just need to pass to people from the front, as it were, a little bit by including them. Any other ways to help parents? Any ways in which we can see parents perhaps making mistakes in this area, and we'd love to try and help them to handle things differently?
Parents being inconsistent. That's something that, you know, I often say to, you know, a parent who's understandably massively upset their gay child who's got a boyfriend, girlfriend, and they said, well, you can't sleep together in our house, when they have allowed their heterosexual child to sleep with the partner they're not married to in their house. And understandably, the gay child has said, well, you know, my brother's sister, I mean, it's unfair. You know, kids are really good at calling that out, and really good at calling that out even in their 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever it is. And just sometimes Christian parents not thinking through about how inconsistent they're being, that they don't approve of sex outside marriage between a man and a woman. They've applied that standard inconsistently across their children in a way that understandably has got the gay child thinking, yeah, you especially don't like me, or you're discriminating against me. So trying to be consistent. I know that's really hard to do as a parent, to be consistent all the time, but trying to be consistent, if you have got, you know, children who've got different sexualities and who are challenging you in different ways, try and be as consistent as possible so they can't accuse you of prejudice against them because of their sexuality.
And I think you can't ignore the fact that this person has entered into this relationship. It will make conversation very odd to not talk about someone who your child or grandchild really cares and values. And thus, I think you've got to find ways in which you can acknowledge the reality of this relationship, which you're comfortable with and you're happy with. And for everyone, that's probably going to feel and look a little bit differently. But for one way I think I quite like is, actually, I can acknowledge that every person has been made in God's image, and that every person has gifts and skills and talents given to them by God. And so that's when I see anyone who's not a Christian, no matter what their sexuality is, who does something which is good and honourable, I want to applaud them for that. I want to say that's a really beautiful thing. That's a really good thing. And it would be really odd is if we saw our child or grandchild in a gay relationship and their partner is doing something kind, and we don't ever acknowledge it. Like, I just think, no, clearly in that act of kindness, they're doing something which is in itself good. And so let's speak about that, and let's highlight that.
That's really helpful.
I was recently talking to a dad of a gay son who's got married to a man. And he was just saying how, how they've gone out of their way to assure their son's partner of how much they love him and how much they appreciate him and how much they see the good that being in a relationship with their son has done for their son. Not in sort of we're fully approved of every aspect of their relationship, because they can't do that from at one level as a Christian, but they do want to acknowledge the good that they have seen happen in their son's life through their friendship, through their relationship with this man, and they do want to assure this man of their love for him. And I think, you know, sometimes as Christians we can think, oh, that is sort of letting the side down, that is compromising. It's not. It's just, as Adam said, it's just recognizing common grace at work. You might not be able to approve of everything in the relationship. That doesn't mean you can't acknowledge the good in the relationship and give, you know, give credit where credit's due to that good, and be, yeah, warm and loving and just polite to somebody who's joined your family, perhaps not in the way you ever wanted, but is now part of your son, your daughter's life, and your life too.
And it's incredible that God can use our human interactions with our children, grandchildren, and with their partners, and actually he can use that to achieve things we might never have imagined. Like, I've got a friend who grew up in a non-Christian home. She was in a lesbian relationship with a woman who was from a Christian home. And obviously this woman who'd grown up in a Christian home, her parents were like devastated that she wasn't living for Jesus and she was in this lesbian relationship. And yet what they probably never perceived happening was the fact that my friend, who didn't grow up in a Christian home but was in this relationship, now later in life has now come to know the Lord Jesus Christ. And like, that was just completely unexpected. And yet it was something probably in the way they acted just back then when that relationship was happening, that lesbian relationship was happening, that even in how they were acting, they were demonstrating Jesus and speaking about Jesus. I'm sure they weren't doing it perfectly. No one does. But that was an unforeseen consequence, was actually how we treat people now might result in our child or grandchild's partner coming to know Jesus later in life. And wouldn't that be an amazing thing?
That's beautiful. Really glad you shared that, Adam. In some ways, what we're appealing for is nuance here. So we're saying that it is possible to love and show grace whilst not agreeing. And in a sense that our culture isn't very good at that often, and there will be the perception that if you can't agree with me, you hate me. We don't think that. We think it is possible to disagree with the decisions people have made, want them to make different decisions, and yet still love them. And as pastors or church leaders, it seems to me we need to say that, use that sort of language, because the way I've seen this go wrong, and again, it would vary from cultures, actually. So in a more traditional culture, it will be, if I disagree with them, I can't show any grace to them. And that's where you perhaps have had gay children excluded from families and so on. I suspect increasingly, and these are the conversations I have most, would be to say, look, Andy, I used to agree with you on sexual ethics, but my daughter is gay, has got into a gay marriage with a lovely woman, and so that means I don't hold your position anymore. I can't tell you how many times I have that conversation these days. And that's because, again, you kind of think, well, to love them, I have to agree with them. And part of me wants to say, we need to train people, actually on a variety of issues, but including this, to show grace and love whilst still disagreeing. And that seems to me where we need to help parents and grandparents actually to land.
Yes, because I think we need to create a paradox in people's minds, don't we? The paradox of like, oh, Christians hate gay people, and yet this Christian seems to really love me. and when people encounter that paradox, suddenly their belief system gets thrown up in the air, and then say, oh, maybe Christians don't actually hate gay people, and actually maybe God doesn't hate gay people, and maybe God actually has some teaching which enables gay people to flourish within his church and within his people. But we're only going to get to that stage if we create that paradox in people's head, that they think we hate them, where actually we love them.
Yeah, or for Christian, you know, Christian sort of grandparents, parents, you know, I know that my yeah, I know that my parents disagree with the fact that I'm in a sexual relationship with this man, but they're really good at looking out for our kids and supporting as much as they do my heterosexual siblings and my heterosexual Christian siblings, even though they've got loads more in common with them. They're just as loving and caring for me and my children. That's, again, the sort of paradox that we'd love to be in place.
One of my favourite phrases, which annoyingly comes from Ed, actually, is, you know, our goal is to baffle people. You know, our goal is to leave people thinking, hang on, they're opposed to gay marriage, and yet they love like this. How does that work? And it, in a sense, the answer to which is we're trying to be like Jesus. Jesus has a really clear sexual ethic, and yet is constantly going towards people who aren't living in line with that sexual ethic. And we just want to train people to be like Jesus and help people through the hardship of this. So again, we'll need loads of sympathy for parents who are finding this tough. But in the midst of that, we're wanting to say, do you want to be like Jesus? So don't give up your sexual ethic, but go towards those who are busy running away from it. I think we're there. Loads more we can say, but we have run out of time. So, Ed, Adam, thank you for sitting in cold church halls to share your wisdom with us. The next episode will be in 2 weeks' time. And in 2 weeks' time, we're going to deal with the question of how do we handle disagreement? So if we're trying to lead churches and people have got a range of opinions, how do we begin to work through that? But in the meantime, plenty of resources on the Living Out website. Feel free to check those out. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.